Hi there, and welcome back to your subscriber-only Inside Total Film podcast. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and I've got with me today Matt Matum.
Hello.
And also Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
This episode, we'll be talking to Sam Mendes about his Golden Globe-winning 1917. We'll be discussing uncut gems, and we'll be looking at the year ahead in movies. But first, let's rate the greatest long takes in cinema.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care.
So we're about to talk about 1917, which is a one-take movie. There are cheats, but to all intents and purposes, it feels like it is. But it's obviously not the first film that's had long takes in it, is it, Matt? Have you got a favourite in the canon of films that have gone for the long ones?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind whenever I think of one-take movies is Russian Ark, because that did it for real. And so it must be applauded for that on its own. And it's a very impressive piece of work. And it really does have this weird, mesmerising, dreamy sort of effect. And I haven't actually seen it for years since it came out in 2002, I think. But that's always what springs to mind when people talk about one-take movies. I think about this one did it for real.
Victoria did it for real as
yeah,
well, didn't
yeah.
it?
And obviously Hitchcock did it with Rope, but it wasn't one take. It was sneaky long takes, but still had the illusion
yeah.
of it.
With Rope, you can kind of see when they're all done, yeah. though, because the yeah. camera just goes into someone's back and you're like, they cut it there.
Yeah. Close up and we're off.
But it's still very impressive for its time. And it kind of shows how much its technology's helped these kind of one take or kind of quote unquote one take movies.
Yeah, I think that's what makes Victoria so impressive, though, because when you're racing through the city and it's just so adrenaline filled and you're just like, you are thinking the whole time, how the hell did they do this?
Yeah.
How did they time this so perfectly for the whole thing yeah. to actually be one take? I mean, 1917 isn't, as you said, one take. So you can, and I think you can see bits of it where they've kind of cut little things together as well, which did remind me of Rope as well.
There's also films that have done really long takes within the film, not a one take movie, but if you think about Atonement and that scene in Dunkirk,
yeah.
that they had to religiously practice and drill. And every time they did it, like, you know, something would go a little bit wrong. One of the horses would stumble, or I think actually McAvoy stumbled on that last take up the stairs slightly, or somebody did. Mm. But they had to keep it because everything had been designed to go just perfectly in that rehearsal. And that's only minutes long, but it's still, when you see something like that, it's astonishing, isn't it? Because you're so used nowadays to the constant cutting and the editing, quick edits of today's movies, that to see something that sort of goes on for that long seems really luxurious.
And especially if it kind of takes you by surprise, like when you first saw Atonement, you might have not known that scene was coming. And it's something, there is something so absorbing about it, and you really do get swept up in the moment.
Yeah. And, you know, things like long tracking shots as well give you that same sort of pause in a film, like the Goodfellas tracking shot that is
yeah.
really long one and goes into the bowels of the Copacabana nightclub and gives you a real sense of somewhere. And Birdman did a lot with that as well, with lots of long takes and unbroken takes.
I think both those as well, they really fit with the film, like Birdman, the whole theatre backstage idea, and Goodfellas, the way it's just him kind of entering this world and he's just how kind of flashy he is and how exciting it is.
I was going to say the kind of grandfather of the Steadicam as well, you know, in The Shining when they're going around the hotel, and that eerie feel that hadn't really been captured on cinema before. And then suddenly the invention of this new piece of technology that allowed Kubrick to do these incredible takes going round and following Danny on his little tricycle, eerie.
Yeah, and the Steadicam obviously is used hugely in 1917. So without further ado, let's go to war.
You have a brother in the 2nd Battalion.
Yes, sir. Is he alive?
And with your help, I'd like to keep it that way. But they're walking into a trap. Your orders are to deliver a message calling off tomorrow morning's attack. If you don't, we will lose 1,600 men, your brother among them.
So So that's 1917. That's Sam Mendes' new film charting two World War I soldiers trying to deliver a message to the front line while the clock ticks away. And the whole film is, to all intents and purposes, one continuous shot, as we said before. But before we talk about whether that works and whether it actually does deceive us, let's find out from Mendes himself how he went about making this film. So Jack, you sat down with him before Christmas in a posh hotel suite.
That is.
And the two of you discussed Bond, theatre and Hitchcock. Shall we have a little listen to what you talked about?
Yes, please.
Okay.
So you actually spoke to Talk Film earlier this year.
I did.
For this film, and one of the things you said was about Bond. And you said that the one shot at the beginning of Spectre really gave you confidence into going into doing this film as a one shot. So I guess I'm wondering, what were the mistakes you made that time round, and how did you avoid them with this?
I don't think I made that many mistakes on that one. I thought it was a really nice shot. I mean,
I'm not saying the shot's not nicer, but I mean, like, technically.
Yeah, but I know what you mean, but it was only an 8-minute shot. I mean, we worked it out, you know, a great length beforehand. What I really learned was, you know, initially I'd had the idea to do the whole opening sequence as one shot. And I got to the point where I thought, this is becoming self-defeating. Mm. I have to cut here to tell the story better. And then, of course, I did. After 8 minutes, I did, you know, start cutting and went into more conventional coverage. So what I learned was, if I ever get to that point on this film, then I have to go back and rewrite it so that I don't need to cut. I'd never wanted to be in the situation where I thought, damn, if only I could cut, this scene would be better. I wanted to make sure that that never happened. So yeah, that's that I learned.
It must be difficult because this film is, obviously it's all one take, but the frustrations that come with that is that whatever you've written down in the script, that's what's going to be in the film. There's no cutting around it.
Nope.
Was there anything where you were like, why did we write this? Or like, this is really frustrating. How do we get around it? Or was it that process of just rewriting the scenes over and over again?
It wasn't just rewriting. It was also, you're writing it in sort of space at the same time. You know, me and Roger Deakins were just sitting there talking about where and how the camera would move for days and days. So even though we were scratching our head about a number of sequences, by the time we came to shoot them, I felt we'd found a solution. So there weren't days, we made very, very few adjustments to camera by the time we came to shoot, partly because we'd rehearsed everything, shot a lot of it in rehearsal, and thought about it for months beforehand. But there were several scenes which confounded us for weeks, really. No Man's Land was really, really hard. Because No Man's Land doesn't exist. You have to invent the events of No Man's Land, how the land falls, what are the details that are going to sustain you, how the reaction, how the cameras, you know, how the camera reads their reaction to what they see around them, and where we see just them and where we see what they're seeing. All of those things, you know, that was a dance that took a while to choreograph. You know, going across the canal in the French town, that for some reason really that took us a long time to find the right way to do it. It didn't seem like an action hero, you know, or somebody who suddenly goes from being a private with not little or no army training to being being Rambo, you know.
Yeah.
So those things, trying to get the tone of it right, that took a long time.
I mean, the technical feat of it is phenomenal, but it also seems like it slightly harkens back to your days on the stage and in theatre, where you've, you know, there, obviously, to put it crudely, that was always one take every night.
Yeah.
And this is that. So did you feel like kind of revisiting those kind of bones and that muscle memory perhaps?
Yeah, and I do think that people treat it differently in movies. I remember when Anne Hathaway won the Oscar for Les Mis, and everyone said, oh my God, she does that song in one shot, you know.
Hmm.
And I remember thinking, unless I'm much mistaken, the entire cast of Les Miserables does it in one take every night, you know, live on stage. You can buy a ticket. So it doesn't seem so strange to me that people do this in one long takes, because of course I'm very used to rehearsing, you know, loads of actors for weeks and then saying on the first preview, right, off you go, I'll see you in 2 hours, you know, when the story's over, and we'll talk about how it went. So for me, that wasn't unfamiliar, nor was it unfamiliar to judge the shape of a story, the rhythm of the story, tempo of the story, without any cuts. That's something I do all the time in the theatre. But on the other hand, it was completely unlike theatre, more so than almost any other movie, because we were constantly on the move, and the landscape and the light and the conditions were constantly changing. So on the other side of it, it felt very cinematic, you know, as if the camera was expressing things that weren't always being said in a way that probably couldn't be the case on stage.
What were the touchstone films that you looked at while working on this? Did you watch Rope? You
know, no, I didn't watch Rope again at all. I hadn't seen Rope in years. I think even Hitchcock himself felt it was not entirely successful. But no, it seemed to behave in quite a different way to most films. And even though, you know, Roger Deakins and I have sat down a lot in the past and looked at movies that are directly relevant to the films we're making, on this one, felt like there wasn't really anything. Because even movies that we admired greatly, like, for example, Son of Saul, which is a very, very subjective, you know, movie and long takes, operated in quite a different way. So much of it is, it's just such a shallow depth of field. So much of it's out of focus.
Yeah.
It really is a very subjective film. We didn't want it to be quite that subjective, you know? And there were a movie like The Revenant, for example, which is long, long sustained takes, but very, very wide lenses, where everything is in focus. We didn't want it to be that either. We wanted it to be in between the two of those things, those two poles, and it had its own way of moving. The camera wasn't always linked with the characters, you know, and yet it was observing time behaving in a normal way. You wanted the audience to believe that the clock was ticking, which would make it very, very unlike a movie like Birdman, for example, which is one take, but is not real time. It spans 3 or 4 days, if I remember rightly, and it goes round in kind of circles through the same environments over and over again. Whereas this was always moving forward through different environments, and time in this movie is very real. So everywhere we looked, it just didn't seem like that was what our movie was. And so we ended up really basing what we were doing on photographs of the period more than anything else. There were 2 or 3 photographs, very simple photographs, but seemed to be, both in their composition and in their depth of field, exactly what we wanted. And then we had to sort of develop the way the camera moved, just the two of us.
So 1917 just picked up 2 major awards at the Golden Globes. So clearly critics at the Hollywood Foreign Press really loved this film. Did you critics love this film? Did what Sam was trying to do with Roger Deakins work, did it cheat you enough to actually be convinced that this was one take?
I'm not sure the one take thing convinced me that it was just a single take. I mean, you could tell that there were bits where it was cut, and there is a very significant part of the film where there is a big cut and you can see it. So it's more of a two-take film, if anything. But it's done really well. You know, the technical feat of it, I found really, really impressive.
Yeah, I found it like actually dazzling, some parts of it, where I just couldn't get my head around how I was floating around certain scenes and how I was in the back of a van and behind people in a van and then outside a van. And even from that point of view, it was actually dazzling to me. What about you, Matt?
Yeah, it's an incredible technical achievement, and it really is something special when you're following them down into the trenches and things like that, and you just haven't really experienced anything like that in a film before on this scale and for this sort of length of time. And if you can stop yourself thinking too much about the technical side, and if you can stop yourself looking for the cuts all the time, it is really, really absorbing and really fascinating. And I think it especially helps that there's such a great performance by George Mackay at the centre. So he's kind of so intense that it really draws you in, even if you might be thinking a bit about how Deakins and Mendes achieved it. You've got that kind of real human element kind of keeping you hooked all the way through, I think.
But isn't it sort of unavoidable to think about that because they've advertised it as such, and because this is such a major part of it? It sometimes feels a bit like it's all the razzmatazz of the making, and sometimes for me the script wasn't as strong as it could have been. Performances were strong, but they were sort of let down a little bit on the script for me. I felt like that was the major thrust, was the dexterity of the camera, the brilliance of the cinematography, the wonderful lighting by Deakins. I mean, there's an astonishing scene when George Mackay's character is running through a sort of strobe lit, ruined French town, and it's honestly absolutely beautiful. But on another level, dramatically, I'm not sure it was as clever.
I think I agree. I thought the script was slightly lacking, especially some of the banter between the two leading characters fell a bit flat. I thought the other main performance wasn't as strong as George's.
I agree.
But he does carry the film. But I think you're right, because I was thinking, wow, this is amazing to look at. But the story was perhaps slightly lacking in places. And it's hard to avoid thinking whenever you see you know, a new famous actor appearing on screen kind of for a 2-minute cameo. It almost felt like a video game in places where suddenly you were like, oh, and now we've reached the next level and the next boss battle or whatever. Mm. And then you're given a new task to go somewhere else. And that felt quite strange. It didn't feel like a normal movie. It felt more like an experience.
I think that's completely fair. I think it is fair to call it an experience. But at the same time, for me, it did totally work as an experience that just immersed you in this situation and present it in a way you haven't seen it before. And again, I kind of agree that the script does have some shortcomings, but in some of those action scenes, because you've been with those characters, you feel that you've been with them all this time and you feel that you've actually been on that journey in this kind of one big scene, if you could call it that, then when something does happen, like when a plane crashes to the ground, it had a different effect on me in the cinema, especially. I mean, I'd be intrigued to see how it works once it comes to home entertainment. And obviously, this
and
is very much...
you can pause it and it's not as propulsive.
And it's very much not a streaming film. You know, I'm glad this hasn't gone direct to streaming after that, because you really do need that full immersion in the cinema. But yeah, on an experiential level, yeah, it is a bit of a gimmick. It is a bit of an experience, but one worth taking, I'd say.
It felt kind of like Dunkirk in that way, because I felt like seeing Dunkirk in the cinema felt like an experience. It was this big adrenaline-filled thing where you were kind of watching it and taken away by just what you were seeing rather than perhaps the story as much. But I know you're a massive Nolan fan who will probably defend that movie. And, I mean,
I loved Dunkirk, and I think I felt more emotionally involved with Dunkirk than I did in this one, and I to this day not really quite sure why.
Yeah,
1917 didn't capture me as much as Dunkirk did. So I think some of the things about it felt that they sort of emotionally rang hollow. We talked about the plane crash, but there's something that happens immediately after that that I felt was too modern for the actual thing that was happening. You know, there was a certain introduction of one character that felt like it was just to, you know, even out the genders, because there's a lot of men in this film. It didn't feel emotionally truthful in some parts. But then having said that, by the time I got to the end of it, I felt fully emotionally invested in it by the time the score was swelling and the odyssey had come to an end.
No, I think that's completely fair. And I agree with what Jack said as well, where he mentioned that the cameos can be a bit distracting because there's a lot of the kind of the very top
Let's
tier.
Name check some of those people.
Yeah, so you've got Colin Firth, Andrew Scott, Benedict Cumberbatch. So yeah, you've got a lot of these big British names, and it does start to feel a bit almost like you start to anticipate the next cameo and you're like, well, who's going to be the cameo around this next corner? But then again, without going into spoilers, there's one quite late on that I actually did find that one very effective. Mm. And so that kind of, again, a bit like you, there were times where I thought certain bits didn't work as well. But that, by the time it got to the ending, and I felt kind of fully won over and I felt like the concept worked.
Yeah.
See, I didn't find that the one at the end really worked for me either. But then I didn't find, to talk about another Nolan film, in Interstellar, where Matt Damon appears. Like, I'm always, whenever there's just a random famous person who you're not sure is in the film and then they appear, I'm always about, lol, it's that person, which isn't very good of me. But I found the same when we finally got to the end and it was like, oh, who's that character they've been talking about? Oh, it's this person. I was a bit like, didn't quite work.
But there is a scene that perhaps shouldn't work. It could be cheesy, but in the hands of Deakins and in the hands of Sam Mendes, where a battalion are waiting to go to battle and there's a young man singing, which goes on for quite a prolonged amount of time and could be horrible, is beautiful and really quite moving. There's moments like that that are just absolute gems within this. So the question is there enough of those things to make this a film that's going to triumph at the BAFTAs over other films? Do you think this is going to go as well as it did at the Golden Globes?
I'm surprised at how well it did at the Globes, because it does feel like a very British film, and it does feel like, you know, a celebration of, you know, our boys over there in World War One and stuff like that. So I imagine it's going to do really well at the BAFTAs. You know, it's got 9 nominations. Mm-hmm. I could see it probably getting best film. I mean, its biggest competition, what, The Irishman and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
And Joker,
yeah, of course.
And it's also one of those films that's very obviously very accomplished.
Yeah.
So, I mean, anybody could say, wow, you know, the cinematography is beautiful in that, you know, the lighting, the costumes are wonderful in that, you know, the editing is fantastic, the sound design is amazing. It's very obviously accomplished. So maybe on those technical awards, it will totally clean up.
And you wouldn't begrudge it either, because it is so accomplished. Like, it gets so much right, and it is a great achievement. So on that level, it doesn't feel like one of these films that's kind of unfairly risen to the sort of top of the awards.
And let's face it, it's a film that, you know, it's not a weird obscurity. It's not something that only critics are watching. I think this is a film that a lot of people will enjoy and audiences will embrace as well. So it would probably be nice for something that audiences have enjoyed to actually see get awards.
So I was wondering what you thought should win Best Picture at the BAFTAs this year.
Well, just to recap on what is actually nominated, there's 1917, of course, The Irishman, Joker, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Parasite, and that's in the Best Film category. But also, remember, you've got a Best British Film category, and that includes 1917 again, Bait, For Summer, Rocketman, Sorry We Missed You, and The Two Popes. So while I would say in the Best Film category, 1917 seems like a good win, will it cancel itself out by winning Best British Film? And then maybe Joker, if we're feeling quite like the BAFTAs are going to be rogue and go for the Joker, or do we think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I mean, I can definitely see 1917 coming to the top of Best British Film, and perhaps that will cancel out. And then I personally wouldn't want to see Joker win. I think The Irishman or Parasite would be deservedly so, but it seems like the general consensus at the moment would perhaps just edge Once Upon a Time in Hollywood to the top.
Yeah, I think that'd be fair. Parasite's getting a lot of awards buzz, more than you would have predicted kind of a few months ago. And with this being quite an undiverse list of nominees in quite a lot of ways, there was quite a backlash to this, the announcement of these nominees, particularly in the acting categories and kind of in terms of there being no female directors as well. Greta Gerwig being a bit shut out for her work on Little Women. So in a way, Parasite's a way to sort of address that if that was to win, kind of looking outside of the obvious sort of Hollywood films. But I don't know if it's still too much of an outside bet for that. But it's a great film. It's one of my favourites out of that selection. So
it's a great selection. Well, we'll see when the BAFTAs roll around. But for now, 1917 is out on Friday the 10th. And shall we move on to another character who is running out of time?
You're taking my money all over town, placing bets.
I'm having very serious second thoughts.
Are you serious right now?
I know I fucked up.
Howard, where's the money right now?
Howard, got my money?
Howard!
Is it too late? I'm done. That means nothing. It meant nothing. Please. Give me another shot.
So that's Uncut Gems, starring Adam Sandler as a Diamond District mover and shaker in New York, who basically has a real problem gambling, and not just in terms of putting bets on things, but actually gambling with his life, with his marriage, with his friends, with his family. And it's by the Safdie brothers. And it is, for me, really the most stressful and intense film I've seen in a long time. I was curled up like a pretzel watching this because I couldn't believe the decisions this guy was making. Was it enjoyable for you, Jack?
I really enjoyed it. It was likewise very, very stressful viewing, especially when he's making these bets and then you don't know which way it's going to go. And it's like his life is in someone else's hands, you know, the hands of a basketball game or whatever he's gambling on this time round. And the stakes just get bigger and bigger and bigger as the movie goes on. And it just doesn't let up at all. It's, you know, going to the cinema this weekend, you don't really have much of a choice between very stressful films. You know, there's one take with 1917 or this film, which is just go, go, go the whole time. What did you think, Matt?
I'm pretty much on the same page as you guys. Yeah, it's immensely stressful, but it is worth seeing. It's kind of, for a film that throws you again, a bit like 1917, kind of throws you into a situation that you may not hopefully have experienced yourself before, but makes you really feel it, and you really feel that you're there, and you really kind of, the intensity is palpable. It's kind of worth seeing for that alone.
Yeah, I think the Safdie brothers do such a good job. I really like Good Time with Robert Pattinson as well.
Yeah.
And they equally get a fantastic performance out of the Sandman in this.
Mm.
You know, you've got these, they've gotten two killer performances, and this one is particularly good. Like Adam Sandler, speaking about this film with like some of my friends, I guess they thought, oh, it's going to be a comedy. Yeah. It's going to be Sandler doing his normal shtick. And it's like, no, not at all.
It is comedy in some senses, very dark.
Dark comedy, yeah.
But yeah, it's astonishing to see him in this. He's so abrasive. I mean, it's just the volume at which he talks, the volume at which everything happens in this film.
Yeah.
So everybody's shouting, talking all over each other. I mean, I don't know what the F-bomb level is on this.
I heard it was in the top 10 of all time or something.
Yeah. And so it's, and the music is really sort of insistent and thrumming, and that's always there. And the camera works all over the place. It's just like, it's insistent, the whole thing, isn't it? And there's no escape from it. But yeah, Adam Sandler is a revelation in this to me. I mean, I loved him in Punch Drunk Love, and I haven't seen him sort of do that again to that level until I saw this, because he's so sleazy and so unapologetic as well about that character, because every time you think he might rescue himself from something with his marriage or his friends, he just does another thing, and I think it's really brave of Sandler to do it so unapologetically. He doesn't invite you to like him.
No, no.
And he doesn't sort of ask for forgiveness. He just goes for it.
But in that sense, it's not that far removed from some of the kind of obnoxious and stupid characters he's played in the past, but it's just in a much better film and a character that just feels tailored for him. And the Safdies wrote this for him back in 2012, which is when the film's set, and then they kind of looked at all these different actors, and it never ended up working out, and eventually...
Yeah, who was the other person they were going to talk?
They got
Jonah
very,
Hill.
Yeah, Jonah Hill.
And they got very close with Sacha Baron Cohen as well, which would have been interesting. You can see that. But it sort of all worked out fortuitously in the end when Silent became free again, and the timing worked out. But it just feels tailor-made for him.
Yeah, and you can see, because the Safdies in their methods of creating characters write huge kind of backstories for each character as well, and you can see it even in the bit parts. You know, the goons they have are just, they're some of cinema's best henchmen, big bads as well, you know,
sweary, sweaty men.
Yeah, and they're really, they just inhabit the part. I know the one, I think his name's Paul in the film, the guy who's terrifying throughout and this kind of complete wild card. You know, he'd never acted before, this is his first role. The casting director saw him on the street and liked the way he walked and the way he looked and stuff. And he just fits the role so well. Terrifying. I'd never like to meet him in real life.
No, I wouldn't.
The whole film just feels so dense as well. It feels like such a fully realised world. Again, if you've never experienced that yourself, or don't know anything about the Diamond District or anything about sports and gambling and that kind of thing, it just feels totally real and
it doesn't sort of spoon feed you it either. There's no sort of Basil exposition on the side going, well, actually, you know, if you take a diamond from here and you're just expected to keep up, and you can. It's easily digestible. But when I saw it in Toronto at the festival there, I saw it with some people who knew those basketball games.
Yeah.
So because it's obviously set in that in the past, they found it an entirely different experience watching the film, because they knew the outcome of these bets and they knew they'd be bad. So they were watching it with even more tension, which I just think is a really interesting layer to put on a film, that you could watch it with no knowledge of any of this or all the knowledge, and it still delivers on that sort of level of tension.
It's funny because Sana's character, there's just enough hope to think that he's going to get better and that you're going to see better days, and he plays it with enough. There's enough empathy for him to be like, oh, I hope he kind of, something goes right for him. And then when it kind of never does, it's quite heartbreaking as well. Mm-hmm. I think that's why it was just so stressful, and you don't know which way it's going to go, but you kind of know it's all downhill.
But I guess it is very fascinating with the whole blending of the real world and this sort of fictional characters they've created, such as Kevin Garnett, the real basketball player playing himself. Again, the match that you mentioned is crucial to the film, so that adds this extra dimension of believability, I guess, and it just really, they really mesh it together really, really well and really convincingly.
And I think they actually, did they not work in the Diamond District themselves as sort of people who took rich clients to sort of the sort of places that Adam Sandler works in order to show them the weird, diamond encrusted watches or the Furby necklaces that he shows off. So it's all there in every sort of layer of this film, that sort of knowledge and that veracity. It's really impressive.
I think it makes them super exciting directors to watch. Not that they weren't already, but especially, you know, moving forward, their next film is a remake of 48 Hours, which seems quite an odd match for them, because it isn't, but the stories they've told so far are, you know, originals, really grounded, not particularly funny at all. And then suddenly this, you know, remake of this old Eddie Murphy film. it's going to be quite interesting to see.
It will.
But then if they apply their sort of wild style to this restricted time frame again, it could be amazing.
Mm. Could be.
Okay.
Fingers crossed.
Let's move on and let's have a look at some other gems coming our way in 2020. Did you like that?
Very
nice one.
Okay, on to our gems. So at the start of the year, now we've got like a load of great stuff coming up. I think we know what Matt's going to be most excited about as the Nolan fan.
Tenet obviously is my most anticipated film of 2020. And we still know very little about it, but the trailer just looked so good. And I saw the prologue as well before Star Wars in IMAX. So yeah, I'm fully into that, even though I know very little about it, yeah.
That's going to be a treat for everyone, surely. Jack, got anything you're looking forward to?
Well, I am very, very much looking forward to Tenet, because I too am a big Nolan fan, perhaps not as big as Matt. But I'd say up there is definitely Dune at the end of the year, yeah, with Timothée Chalamet.
Very nice.
I think anything Denis Villeneuve's touched seems to have been absolute gold, and to see him take on something that's going to be so huge in scale and with a massive budget and with this amazing cast. Mm. I really can't wait. You know, we've had a huge sci-fi film every December with Star Wars, and now it's someone else's turn to kind of have that mantle. And I think everyone's going to be talking about it, and hopefully it's going to be good. I mean, they've already got a spin-off TV show coming as well, so fingers crossed.
Yeah, that does sound exciting. I'm going to put Top Gun Maverick at the top of my list for pure nostalgia and, you know, like Highway to the Danger Zone glory. I can't wait. And the trailer that we've just had recently looks like it's ticking all those boxes, but also bringing in all of that experience Tom Cruise now has of flying and doing stunts and doing the most ridiculous things that he's been doing in a Mission Impossible, and throwing that into that Top Gun scenario.
And just that realism that they bring to the Mission Impossible stunts.
Yeah.
Applying that to Top Gun is just such an exciting prospect.
It's a marriage made in heaven. I'm also going to throw in there Wonder Woman 1984, because that was obviously delayed. We were supposed to have that last year. We've got it this year. And it just looks fantastic.
And I love the way that DC are just doing these very different type of sequels at the moment. So not just following the typical structure you expect, you know, just, oh, let's just bang out another one that's exactly the same as the first one. It's like very different time period, different setting, you know. So
yeah, and you could say, I mean, it's the same with Birds of Prey.
Exactly.
You know, it's this non Suicide Squad sequel that's kind of a sequel but definitely not one. And to see someone else's take on that world and bringing Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn back, because she is so excellent in that role. I'm really intrigued to see what that film's going to be like and how, I think it's going to be super fun. I mean, you interviewed the cast and crew.
I did, and you can read it in the current issue of Total Film magazine, still out.
Did it make you very excited for it?
Yeah, it really did, especially just the way they talked about how the whole tone is kind of filtered through Harley herself. So again, just a completely different type of comic book movie to what we've seen before. So yeah, really can't wait to see that.
What about Mr. Bond? Let's not forget No Time to Die is Daniel Craig's last outing.
This is looking like one of the blockbusters to beat at the moment, I think. Just, again, a perfect trailer. Just everything you'd want from a Bond movie. The locations, the cars, the gadgets, the guns. The fact it is addressing the fact that it's Craig's last Bond. And so there's that extra dimension to it as well. Yeah, can't wait for this one.
Yeah, and Rami Malek seems kind of tailor-made to be a Bond villain at this stage. He looks so good in the trailer and what we've seen so far, even though we know so little. But even just him as a person, it just feels so right for that role. So I mean, I can't wait for that as well. I think it's going to be hopefully a fitting send off. And I think we've said before that most Bond films do and this is it. We're ready for a good one.
Yeah, we are. Going from one franchise to another, how about, you know, the Marvel stuff we've got coming up this year? We've got Black Widow and Eternals, so they are both big and also really strong female leads, which is really exciting to me.
I would say Black Widow feels a few years too late. It would have been good to have had this film, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, when she was the big star in the MCU, and they could have really done with a female-led superhero film before Captain Marvel as well. You know, they have been lacking. So it is really exciting to finally see her get her moment, even though it's difficult because we know the inevitable outcome of her life. I think that's what makes it difficult. Saying that, you know, you've got Florence Pugh.
Yeah, awesome. We're going to find out what happened in Budapest.
We're going to find out what happened in Budapest. There's so much exciting stuff around this film. I think it's going to be great. I'm more excited for The Eternals, which I think is going to be super, super cool. Because especially...
Angelina Jolie.
And director Chloe Zhao, who did the cowboy film, The Rider.
That was so good.
Which was really, really impressive and so good. So to see her kind of have this huge budget to play with, super exciting.
Let's talk about really male franchises now. Bulging muscles, big cars, Fast and Furious 9. That is wheeling its way towards us. That's out at the front end of this year. But no Dwayne Johnson. How are we feeling about that?
I was actually a fan of Hobbs and Shaw. I enjoyed it. But it'll be interesting to see the franchise go back to its proper family roots and back to the Toretto's, Vin Diesel front and centre. This is his franchise, really. And I suppose with Hobbs and Shaw, as much as I enjoyed it, maybe it didn't really feel like a Fast and Furious film just because you had no Toretto's in there. So, yeah, getting back to the family sounds like a good idea, I think.
Yeah, and a quarter mile at a time.
Yeah, and you just know, like, Fast and Furious 8 was just so bonkers. It's like, what are they going to have done this time to top it? Like, what kind of vehicles are they going to be driving? So you just know it's going to be immense fun.
Yeah.
Do we know much about this film? Is Charlize back?
Yes.
Charlize is back. But yeah, we don't really know much at the moment. Like, no trailer yet. Hopefully soon. But
and yeah, hopefully she's had a haircut.
Yes, because that wasn't good before. And finally, I'm going to throw into the mix for another bit of nostalgia hit. Ghostbusters. We've seen the trailer now and it actually looks pretty good.
It's very much along that Stranger Things vibe of younger people hunting down ghosts and in a small town. I think it could be really exciting. I mean, I liked Paul Feig's Ghostbusters as well. I thought it was quite fun. So it's a slight shame perhaps to see that put to the side. But again, very exciting to see some of the old characters hopefully coming back and... You know, the old Ghostmobile and stuff like that. It should be really fun.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's a shame to kind of completely ditch Paul Feig's, but at the same time, it's nice to be back in the same world as the original characters. And I'm just super intrigued to see what Jason Reitman does with it, because we've known him as the indie guy who does all these kind of Sundance movies. But now he's actually stepping up to blockbuster, and the fact that it's one that his dad directed, it's such a sort of fascinating thing. I don't know if that even ever happened before, where someone's inherited a franchise from their parent.
All I can think of is Christopher Tolkien taking on from his dad. So, and that's the book world, though. Yes. So,
yeah, he's got everything to play for and also everything to lose. There's quite a bit of pressure on him. So let's hope that that is good.
Talking of scary films as well, because the Ghostbusters does look a bit spooky, the Ghostbusters Afterlife. Any other horror films you're particularly looking forward to this year?
Just a little quiet one.
Ooh.
Quiet Place Part 2.
Man, that was a good trailer.
Yeah, really good trailer, and so exciting that we're going to see day one of that world. What happened? How did they escape it when everyone else clearly got eaten? Yeah, and how are they going to survive now that John Krasinski's dead? It's really exciting. And, you know, will we actually see him? Will he be there in a flashback? Will we actually get to see more of Papa Abbott, who was, you know, dad goals in the first
one? We can only hope.
And also in the horror vein, you have The Lighthouse, which I know we all have seen quite a while back now, but it's only just reaching UK cinemas for the awards season. RPATS, Willem Dafoe.
Black and white, like a weird ratio, lots of sort of weird talk about lobsters and beans and farting and mermaid sex.
It's a hugely unconventional film, but if you fancy something a bit unconventional, you'll kind of love it, and it'll be unlike anything you've ever seen before.
And you can probably say the same about Parasite as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is soon reaching cinemas next month, I believe. I adore this film.
And I hope as well, because of the awards buzz that it has got, that it will give it that slightly higher profile. Perhaps some more people will kind of get the chance to see it than might have done had it not been in the race like it is.
The less you know about the story, the better it is.
Yeah, it takes a left turn in the middle and you don't want to know what that is.
Nope.
Okay, so that is our roundup of the year. There's obviously loads more to talk about and we will be talking about in future podcasts. So that's it for this podcast. But before we go, here's a question from a reader. Sarah Davies asks, do you ever become friends with the people you interview? I'm not friends with anyone on a sort of they pop round for tea level, but you know, Tom Cruise did send me a cake this year for Christmas and I feel like we're very close now. So I think that's me and Tom besties.
I haven't really stayed in touch with anyone too well, I'm afraid.
Just the odd Facebook friend.
I did have have a Facebook friend in Josh O'Connor once, but then I was at a party and thought it'd be really cool to show everyone. And then it turns out Josh O'Connor unfriended me. I'm sure it was nothing personal. But
just reaching out to Josh.
Yeah.
I mean, heartbroken here, Josh. Can you
please friend him again? If you're listening.
Yeah, add him back in. What about you, Matt?
I mean, there's a lot of people you do strike up a good rapport with, hopefully, and especially if you interview them time and time again. But sadly, I don't have anyone around for dinner, but yeah. Purely professional.
Maybe one day Nolan will be round.
Yeah. Invite him round for a cup of tea. I hear he likes a nice cup of Earl Grey.
I'll get some Earl Grey in.
So that's your answer, Sarah. I'm afraid not. So that's it from us. Join us next time and we will say goodbye. Goodbye, Jack.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Matt.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.